If you want to, why don't we go around first and just do some introductions. I'm John Lesh. I'll be chairing today along with Senator Mua, who I guess will be doing that the next time we meet. And the tape's on, right?
Yes.
Okay. St. Paul, 66A.
I'm Representative Tony Cornish from Good Thunder in District 24B.
Okay. Introducing staff, too.
Matt Gehring, an analyst from House Research.
Kate Weeks, DFL Research with the House.
Dennis Verdon, Research Republic.
Kathy Pontius, Senate Counsel.
Warren Limmer, I represent Northwest Hennepin County.
I'm Don Betzel. I represent Fridley, Fridley Park Lane, and Mountain Zoo. And for House members, that means Representative Tom Tilburn and Representative Scott Krabs.
Oh, Sheila Charlie, Legislative Assistant to Senator Moore.
My House members are Representative Sheldon Johnson and Representative Tim Mahoney.
Thank you. I should point out, too, my senator is Ellen Anderson in St. Paul. Representative Mulry just finished his bill, and he'll be up shortly, I'm sure. So his bill was up on the floor. But Senator Limmer, did you have a comment?
I didn't want to mention my state reps for fear that it might go badly against us in decision making.
It may. Everything you say can and will be used
I'm
against
sure
you
will.
Here. So, I thought what we could do initially is I have had conversations with Senator Moore, and we thought what we would do is ask research to go through the bill. Thank you very much for the side-by-side comparison about these items in the bill. People may be familiar. We also have here with us representatives from the city of St. Paul, including John Choi, the city attorney, who was instrumental in helping us out move this bill forward. In the first instance, there are minor changes, but for the most part, the bill is very similar with changes that were made with respect to rental property, etc. So why don't we go ahead and Matt and Kate and Dennis, if you, what's that? And Kathy, anyone else on the side? Okay, excellent. So if we can go through and start off, Matt, is that all right if you start us off?
Sure. I think probably the easiest way is to see the differences between the House and Senate versions is actually to take a look at the side-by-side. Kathy did this, and I think it's very accurate. Let's see. I know the best way to just want to go section by section. Or
you know, if Kathy did the side-by-side and is more familiar with it because of that, if you want to have her go through it, that's okay.
Well, I mean, I guess the main differences between the House and Senate version are just that the Senate bill has several additional provisions that the House version doesn't have, so it might be best to have Kathy explain the new provisions that the House hasn't seen before.
Okay, so through the ones... We're going through the House provisions first, right, that are there that the Senate doesn't have? Or what did you just say? Can you repeat that?
Well, so the Senate has largely what the House has, but the Senate also has some additional provisions that the House doesn't have.
Okay. Could we initially just go through those provisions that the House has that the Senate does not have? And then if the majority of the provisions are Senate-only language, we can go through those next, and maybe Ms. Pontius can go through that or what have you. Does that sound like an okay way to go?
It's my understanding that the House bill is the bill as it was introduced.
That's correct.
So it would appear that whatever amendments are were those of the Senate, and the only place that this was offered in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I believe it was amended on the Senate floor. So those are two places where we have Senate members.
Thank you, Senator Betzel. And I think that's correct. However, there was some House language that was taken out because it was replaced in a different area in the Senate bill. So I just wanted to clear that up first. Are people familiar with that? Matt, are you familiar with that?
No.
Yeah.
I tell you what, actually what might be easiest if we just go section by section, we can just explain.
Okay, let's do that.
What's there. So the first section is the definition section. The differences here, like the House side, the House has definitions of continuously or regularly criminal gang and gang activity. There's a difference in the definition of continuously or regularly in that the House says at least 5 separate incidents or occurrences in a period of not long time. Continuous serosa regularly on the House side means 5 times in a period of not more than 12 months. The Senate version says 5 separate incidents or occurrences in a period of not more than 12 months. In the definition section, the Senate also has a definition of the word place that the House does not have.
And I do have a question for any of the senators who can answer that. In terms of those changes, with respect to the language of continuously or regularly that was added in and that section, is there anyone who can answer what was the, I mean, I understand that that was originally placed in under Subdivision 1 of Section 2, and then it wasn't in Subdivision 2 of that section. I'm curious as to the arguments that were made at the time when that was placed in and why that was, if people remember.
Mr. Chair, what I would like to do is, if it's all right with the committee, I'd like to have Mr. Choi come up to the table. This bill, when we were putting this bill together, we had counsel work very closely with the city attorney and with my office to make sure that we were able to craft a bill that was workable or implementable at the city level. And so some of this language was vetted with both the city of St. Paul, city attorney's office, as well as city of Minneapolis, to make sure that it was implementable. And the recommendation for continuously and regularly came from the city attorney's office because they feel that it was more tightly crafted and it would make the statute more closely workable. So I would ask Mr. Choi to provide the context if you're interested in that.
Mr. Choi, is there a reason why that language was not in the original House version in that place? How did you draw the language where it was sans that in the first place?
Well, I think the original, Mr. Chairman and members of the conference committee, John Choi, St. Paul City Attorney for the record, and thanks for allowing me to clarify. I think the original House File 49 and the original as introduced Senate File 493 was modeled after the Texas law, and I think that was just the way that they had written it. I think after introduction and speaking with many attorneys in the city attorney's office, many of the civil attorneys who would be enforcing these provisions, one thing that struck us with respect to the Texas statute that we were modeling House File 49 after was is that they had interchangeably used terms like habitually, frequently, and then they also reference 5 times, and they don't say separate incidents or occurrences. So I think the goal here was to kind of narrowly define what continuously or regularly would mean, and what we would say here is that it would be 5 separate incidences or occurrences, and then use that throughout the law, the proposed law, so that there is some consistency and to avoid any potential challenges that could occur as a result of the use of the words habitual and the use of the words frequently and just in clarifying times. We thought that would be a much better approach.
And when you say we thought, did you draw on, Mr. Choi, any language from similar statutes in other states like California, or did you just change it based upon your own understanding that it would be tighter language?
Just from our offices, you know, indicating to me that that this would be much more constitutionally defensible.
Is Mr. Choi, are those terms defined in other locations in Minnesota statutes or in the criminal code or civil law?
I think they are, and I think there was a more defined definition of the word habitual in Texas law, and I think that's one of the reasons why they didn't define it under their statute as introduced.
Senator Moore, did you have a question? Oh, Senator Betzel? I have an additional question then, Mr. Choi. This is defined as a nuisance. This is a nuisance cause of action. And in the nuisance law that we currently use, we only need 2 incidents in order to take action. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So is there a reason why we upped this all the way to 5 in this law as it was drafted that you're aware of?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I think based upon the Texas law, that used 5 times, and I think that was the basis for using that. But I have spoken with Commander Tim Flynn of the St. Paul Police Department, and you know, from his perspective of making this more workable, any number a little bit closer to 2, which is what is used in the under 617.80, which is the public nuisance law that we already have in statute. And under that statute, you need 2 or more incidences within a 12-month period. And that's worked pretty, I think that law has worked pretty well statewide. So the concern would be the 5 being, you know, whether or not that would ever occur. We think that probably would, but it's just a matter of, it's hard to say until we actually sit down and try to gather the evidence.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Choi. And then if it's okay with committee members, I think we can continue to go through section by section.
Section 2,
yeah.
The difference here, subdivision 1 is identical on both the House and Senate side. Talking about gang activities, criminal gang is continuously irregularly engaged in gang activities as a public nuisance. Subdivision 2, the use of place. On the House side, the House just says the habitual use of a place by a criminal gang for engaging in gang activity is a public nuisance. The Senate says the continuous or regular use of a place by a lessee or tenant to engage in or allow gang activity by a criminal gang is knowingly permitted by the owner or a person who is responsible for maintaining the place on behalf of the owner is a public nuisance.
And I do have a question about that for the senators who recall this, any one of the senators, about the discussion that was had in committee on this and who testified on it and why it was decided that that section should be divided in the way it was. Or perhaps if Mr. Choi could answer that question as well.
Was that subdivision 5 that you're talking about?
No, look at subdivision 2, yeah, subdivision 2. This may be, just so members know, I believe Representative Mulry had a question about this as well regarding the definition of place. My reading of the Senate language under Section 2, kind of skipping ahead to a certain extent, but because we are on the conversation about use of place right now, Subdivision 1 of that provides the cause of action with respect to gang activities. Criminal gang that continuously or regularly engages in gang activities is a public nuisance. The Subdivision 2 is use of place, continuous, as was stated, use of a place by the lessee or tenant to engage is also a public nuisance. So does this, maybe Mr. Choi, if you could answer the question, does this statute in any way preclude us from a cause of action against gang members in public parks or anywhere like that that is not, say, that does not fall under the definition of use of place?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my recollection of this amendment, I think this was made on the Senate floor, and I think it was your amendment, Senator Limmer, and I think by reading this, my impression of it would be is that you would be limiting the cause of action under Section 2, Subdivision 2, to the situation where it would be a lessee or a tenant.
Representative Mulry?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm sorry I had a bill up on the floor, so I'm late. But as I read Subdivision 5, it basically almost guts the worst. I mean, it guts the effectiveness of this bill as far as the worst problems in my district. And I probably have the most problems of any place in the state right now. And so to see that happening is not encouraging.
Now I'm catching up on my memory on why this was. There was a concern by a number of landlords that were concerned with how do they control the behavior of people that aren't tenants. Someone could be walking by the street, walking into the yard and doing something. How can they be held responsible for an individual of that kind? Maybe they're a member of the gang, maybe they're not, but that raises another question of how you improve that. But the question or the language here gives a little bit more specificity, and it recognizes the exact responsibility of what a potential landlord or a landlord could have regarding behavior on his property. I would imagine it may be somewhat difficult to allow a landlord to figure out what's in the mind of a passerby if he may have some criminal intent, and then be held responsible for it. So if this was introduced to bring a little bit more clarity to the definition, and also to tie the relationship tighter to the bad actor that was playing the role.
Senator Moore.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, I guess I'd like to hear a little bit more about your concern why this definition of place is somehow not useful, because I think that this has been vetted with the city attorney's office in Minneapolis, and they have indicated that the language here, they found that it was adequate to address their needs if they were going to use this. So, I mean, I guess what I'd like to hear, and as we look through different scenarios, in the Senate, at least when we were discussing this, we didn't find the definition of place to exclude any circumstances where if the city wanted to go after them, that it would somehow be prohibited from doing that. And so, you know, if there's a particular maybe scenario that you could think of where this would be problematic, maybe we should talk about that to see whether or not it truly is going to somehow be excluded in this definition.
I wanted to actually, and one second, Representative Mullery, but in response also to some things I think may be helpful, according to my understanding, on Section 2, it's bifurcated the two causes of action. One, towards a criminal gang. We can achieve a suit towards a criminal gang and individual gang members vis-a-vis their continuous and regular engagement in gang activities. Secondarily, we can seek to enjoin gang activities or an individual from being in a particular place also because that place is continuously or regularly used by a criminal gang and is knowingly permitted by the owner. My understanding was that Subdivision 2 also allowed us to enjoin not just the gang member, but enjoin an owner of a particular property, whether that be a gas station or, for that matter, an apartment building, which is a conceivable situation. Hence, Senator Limmer's statements, where I guess my thought is, and I understand why this language was probably put in, however, in these cases where an individual just wanders by, a landlord or an owner is relatively judgment-proof anyway, because I don't know there's really much we could get on them in terms of fingernails sunk in. You can enjoin a landlord from renting to an individual, or you can enjoin them from knowingly allowing someone on the property. I don't know what else we could do, but Representative Mullery, you wanted to respond?
Well, yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Moore, and I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, if your interpretation, maybe that's correct, that there's two causes of action here, but I'm not sure that, and I still would want to, if there is two causes of action, I would want the second one
that if there is something about being in a place, because the place definition in the Senate language says a structure or a portion of the structure of the land surrounding the structure. Now, for instance, Cottage Park in my district is a huge problem. There's murders, shootings there all the time. There is no structure even there. So we're excluding one of the major hangouts. I mean, I've been to meetings where the gang strike force, back when Todd Joins was the U.S. attorney, and they had just taken one shot of the people there one night, and I think there were 31 that night that had charges of aggravated assault, attempted murder, things like this. So
when I say Senator Moore, and then Senator Betzel, did you have a comment to that? I just want to go to you and then
Senator. Mr. Chair, Representative Mulray, I mean, what we focused on the Judiciary Committee was that we assumed that these were going to be individual places, and as you talked about, knowingly permitting the act. Well, if you're talking about Cottage Park, which I would assume is a public facility, are we going to, the language in this bill would say that it was prima facie evidence the person who owns or is responsible for maintaining the place knowingly permitted the act. So is a city knowingly permitting the gang activity because the city owns the park, and are we subjecting the city to a lawsuit because we are permitting the gang activity? I mean, I think that's the logic that we're leading to here. We're trying to figure out who the owner is, and you're suggesting it's a park and the city owns it. So why would we want to do it that way? I mean, I'm not suggesting that the gangs don't hang on parks, but the language of your bill in what you're suggesting leads to a consequence that I don't think we want to go.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Betzel, that might be a way to get some action by some people, but what if it's there's vacant lots that would be excluded from this because there's no structure there, and they're owned by somebody that there's no structure.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Mulray, I think our concern was that the bill defines some public nuisance as individual use of a place. It refers to places throughout it, but it's quite vague, and I don't, if a place is a place of, does it mean a vacant lot, does it mean a park, does it mean a building? We don't know, and I don't think that we were having a desire to pass a bill that is vague. If we don't understand what it means, I think we felt the responsibility to kind of clarify it. If you're feeling that the sentence language in defining a place is too restrictive, maybe we have to add additional clarifications, but to take what the House has doesn't answer any questions because it doesn't really define what a place is anywhere. And we think that that's kind of critical. If you're going to hold people criminally responsible or public nuisance or whatever, I think you're going to have to be kind of definitive of what you're talking about. And the House language doesn't do that.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mulray, perhaps this will help to clarify. I think that when the Senate was contemplating place and the definition of use of a place, we're contemplating that in the context of attributing some responsibility to the people who have control and responsibility for a certain place. So the definition of use of place and the definition of place is applicable only, or it pertains only to when we're looking at who to hold accountable for the place. And so that pertains, so the definition the definition of use of place and the definition of place really only pertains to the landlords or the people who have responsibility over a particular place. When you're talking about a group of gangs hanging out maybe in a parking lot or at a park, now we're looking at the actions of the gang members and the activities of the gangs. And I don't think that when we do that then we're talking about the gang members themselves continuously and regularly engaging in gang activities, period. You know, not necessarily making we can't attribute the place definition to them, because what we're going after them is their action that's continuously and regularly. And so that's why I think when the Senate was looking at this, we're really looking at gang activities to be applicable to the gang members. But the lack of control over a place by a person who is responsible for it, who in essence is giving permission to the gang activities to take place, we have to hold that person accountable, those individuals accountable. And so that's where our definition of place and use of place came back to focus on the people who are responsible for the place.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moore, and that may be, I don't know that I'm disagreeing, but there are, at least in my district, there are a great number of vacant lots where basically there's nothing done by the owner to have them not in there. And I guess that would seem to me just as much as if it was a an apartment building and they're hanging around on the lot around there, a vacant lot is the same way would have.
Senator Moore?
Well, Mr. Chair, and I think that we would be open to entertaining an amendment to add a vacant lot to the definition of place to make sure that we are inclusive in the potential spaces, because you're right. An owner of a vacant lot is someone who needs to take responsibility for that. And so if we want to do that, I think that we would not be opposed to adding that to the definition of place. And so we can have council take a look at that and see if they can help do something with that. I agree with you that the vacant lot is not here, because we only talk about parking area or the land surrounding the place. And in looking at how to closely tailor, we're thinking of a landlord who might say, there's a vacant lot next door, the activity is taking place, why are you attributing that to us? And we're trying to come up with what's a good way to kind of say, you're only responsible for things up to your lot line. Anything beyond your lot line, you really don't have responsibility for, like the sidewalk and the street corner with the lamp. I mean, you can't hold a landlord responsible for that. So we were trying to narrowly tailor the areas of responsibility for the landlord. A vacant lot, though, is something that I don't think is in here, and I think we ought to look at.
Senator Betzel.
Although, Mr. Chair, I'll point out, Section 7 of the House language talks about evidence, and it says that proof of the gang activity is frequently committed at a place. Proof that a place is frequently used. It's prima facie evidence the person who owns or is responsible for maintaining the place knowing it's from the act. I suspect that if you're going to hold the person responsible, it's just simply because you own the vacant lot, even if it's somebody who lives outside of the state, you own it. Even if they, how would they know if it's a vacant lot? They say, how am I supposed to know? I think we're trying to get at behavior that we can hold people responsible for. And if it's a vacant lot, they're not maintaining it for sure. I think you don't maintain a vacant lot. I don't know how you do that. So, or mow it, I don't know. I don't know what you do with a vacant lot. But so you're saying just because somebody owns a vacant lot and gangs go to a vacant lot, that is going to be prima facie evidence that they are allowing gang activity. That may be a stretch. I think the court's going to have a tough time. I see that a lot different from somebody who has a building. When people are living in it and they're owning it, maintaining it, and have responsibilities as an outside landlord, that's a big difference. So I don't know. It may be very true, as Representative Moore says, that sometimes gangs don't go to vacant lots. But how do you, what is the standard, what is the threshold for holding people responsible and then saying, get those gangs out of there? I don't know.
Perhaps I could ask Mr. Choi to address this as well. When I look at this provision, I think in terms of on the street and probable cause, when an officer does not have probable cause to enter a building, whereby we may need help in enjoining an owner of that building if they're complicit in renting to gang members. But I think maybe they don't need probable cause to go in a lot if they can see gang activity or hand-to-hand transactions. However, how do you see this being effectively used as a tool for law enforcement in St. Paul, Mr. Choi?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. To your point, Representative Mullery, I mean, I think under Section 2, Subdivision 1, I think that even if it is at a vacant lot, the key issue, the key words are that. We, and as Senator Mua pointed out, we'd be going after the activity. And I'm not so sure that the use of place actually is really an issue for the issues that you're kind of talking about that are happening in Minneapolis. Because what would happen typically, and just talking this through with our police department, as an example, what could happen is, let's say that there is a particular bus shelter in the city of St. Paul that happens to be being taken over by gang members, and let's say that they're charging individuals for even coming into the shelter and harassing individuals, and they're dealing, this is a base for dealing drugs. Hypothetically, let's say if that was occurring somewhere, what would happen and what we would contemplate as a part of what the police department would do, they may decide to have they may have video surveillance of this particular area for a while and basically gather the evidence, and if we could get gang members, a whole laundry list of them who are committing these activities and doing it continuously and regularly, then we would go to court in a civil proceeding, get an injunction, and hopefully the judge would agree that it would be reasonable to enjoin them from doing certain activities, for instance, you know, being at that bus stop, being engaged in other types of things that would be related to gang activities. That's ultimately how it would work. And regardless of where the place is, we would essentially use Section 2, Subdivision 1. That's really the key for us from our perspective. That's the most important language. With respect to the use of place and the landlord situation, that's not going to be used probably as much, because we also have the tool under 617.80, which is the public nuisance statute as well, to address some of these issues. I mean, I think it's important to have this, but I think the focus really is, the most important part from our perspective is Section 2, Subdivision 1. We find that language to be the most useful, and the way that it's written right now, I think the Senate language, you know, that would work very well for us, just that particular Subdivision 1.
Thank you, Mr. Choi. Well, Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, then Mr. Choi, do we even need to talk about place anywhere in this bill? If it's the activity that you're trying to get at, why do we even need to talk about place at all?
Well, I think there could be, under 617.80, they would not be talking about gang activity. That's not listed as one of those things that would, and if you look at the definition of gang activity as defined under both House File 49 as introduced and Senate File 493, the second engrossment, they define that to mean a number of things, and the definition broadens what a public nuisance can be as long as it's continuous and regular. For instance, you know, you would have the serious crimes and then the criminal damage to property, trespass and disorderly conduct. So it still could be used potentially as a tool, because it would kind of expand a little bit beyond the public nuisance statute that we already have in the state.
Mr. Chair, now I'm confused, because I just thought you heard a few minutes ago saying that Section 2, Subdivision 1 was the key.
Yeah.
And that Section 2 on the place and so forth was less important, as I understood your testimony. So my question was, why do we even need to talk about the place? If it's the gang activities that you're trying to get at, if it's the nuisance of the gang activities, is it important? And forget how the bills were introduced or what happened. I mean, we're trying to pass a bill that is going to make sense and be able to be enforced. Do we even need to talk about the place and how to try to define the place if it's the gang activity that is what we're trying to get at as a nuisance?
Well, Senator Moore, but first, I don't know how many many people at this table saw New Jack City 1991. Got an Oscar for the best soundtrack score, best new song, a pop song. And a gang in New York City took over an apartment complex. And Judd Nelson, who was the New York City cop, did a great job of getting them out of there without an ordinance such as this. But anyway, I think there are some instances where it could come in handy. Senator Moore.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that the value in having the landlords in here is that it creates an opportunity to have them be part of the conversation about the gang activities. But to some extent, the definition of place and use of place is also providing a tool to landlords, actually, to help themselves address the gang activities. So my anticipation is that the cities want to go after the activities of the gangsters. But if the gang activity is occurring at a certain building, and that landlord or that private business or whoever objects to that, I think that they themselves can use this through the city attorney's office and basically get a judge to enjoin a private business. Like, for example, in the last couple of months, Metro Funeral Home Maplewood, there have been a couple of incidents of gang shooting involving different gangs at a funeral home. And the funeral home owners have said to me, is there a way we can, you know, get some kind of police order telling these gang members that they cannot come to funerals, even if it's their relatives, they can't come anymore. Because when they come, they get into altercations and they fight each other. And my first instinct was, if this was law, I think the funeral home, you know, operators hopefully would be able to go to the city and maybe be able to get an order saying these gang members can no longer convene or come to this place. So it is both a tool for the city to go after the activities of the gangsters, but I think it is also a tool for property owners to be able to enjoin gang activities from taking place at their property.
Perhaps in the interest of time, if there's...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think I understand the problem that Senator Moore is bringing up, and I think we have to address that. I think also, in looking back at it, the reason I thought that we were trying to get grounds for injunctions against activities in this bill. And so therefore, I go back to why I liked the, I guess it's the original bill, at least it's House File 49 is introduced, which under number two, it didn't matter what it was, if it was a park or not. And Senator Betzel brings up, are we going to sue the city? That's not the issue. The issue is making it easier to get an injunction, in my view, against gang activity in Cottage Park. And that can be under subdivision two very easy under the original bill. And so I think before we start cutting out things, we better look at the whole.
I think the intention here today is to go through, to try to continue to go through this section by section, and it's been vetted quite a bit, and maybe we could move on looking at the other sections, and we could have discussions on that afterwards before we bring forth our proposals. So, Mr. Gary, if you want to continue through section by section.
Okay. Section three, this is the actual section that allows the lawsuit to take place. The big difference in, well, first of all, in the House version, it's not divided up into subdivisions. The House version allows a county or city attorney, the attorney general, or a resident of the state to sue to enjoin a public nuisance. The Senate version does not allow any resident of the state to sue for an injunction. They just limit the county or city attorney or attorney general. The second piece, which is paragraph B in the House version, person who habitually associates with others who engage in the gang activity may be made a defendant in the suit. On the Senate side, it's again this same distinction. The person who continuously or regularly engages in gang activity may be made a defendant. The Senate then goes on in quite a bit of detail and requires, also permits the owner or person responsible for maintaining a place to be made a defendant in the suit. The House does this as well, but the Senate requires that they may not be made a defendant in the suit until 60 or more days after they've been provided notice. And the notice is provided in Subdivision 2 of the Senate version. The notice requires that it be in writing and served personally or by certified mail, and state that the nuisance is occurring in a particular place, and specify the type of nuisance, summarize the evidence indicating that the nuisance is occurring, must inform the recipient that failure to abate the nuisance within 60 days may result in them being made a defendant in district court. The notice also must inform the owner of the option to cancel the lease by bringing a motion under Subdivision 3. And again, Subdivision 3, which is also not in the House version, provides for the owner to bring a motion to cancel a lease in the event this nuisance is occurring. So.
I have a question for Mr. Choi. Mr. Choi, isn't a landlord already able to cancel a lease for illegal activity like this under current state law?
I can't tell you that, but most leases are going to have the criminal activity provisions in most leases. I'm not sure if there is a provision.
Well, perhaps
state
council
statute.
could address it then. There are several unwritten provisions in landlord-tenant law that run with a lease, whether they're written into it or not, including the covenant of quiet enjoyment. I know state law explicitly provides for voiding a lease where narcotics or, I believe, prostitution or illegal guns are used. It's automatically void for those provisions, but I know narcotics. What's that?
There's a requirement of incidents.
Representative Mulry states that it requires incidents, but if counsel could address that, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, the language that's in the Senate bill is basically taken almost verbatim out of the other nuisance law, and I think you're certainly correct. There may be other laws that landlords could rely on, but this is kind of another tool that they could use, or once that notice is served on them, that in and of itself would give them authority to go into court to try to cancel the lease. So it would probably be a little bit easier once this happens than going under the traditional provisions in landlord-tenant law. So they might have other remedies as well, but this would be something else that they could do.
Okay, my other question for
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Lover.
I remember the discussion we had in the Judiciary Committee. We know that there is a contractual relationship between landlord and tenant. And then, of course, you have the obligation to, as a landlord, to own the property under a license to rent the property by the city. And if the city comes along and says, you have a problem with the tenant, we're trying to avoid putting the landlord in conflict with both his tenant under contract and also with an order by the city. And I believe that the Senate language here would give a greater opportunity for the landlord to be a working partner with the city, recognizing the problem and then thereby canceling the lease under the protection of law. And the one thing that escapes me from my memory right now is whether or not you need a conviction in order to break that lease under the enjoinder that you talked about. Here, it would simply be the city making the charge that you have a problem with the tenant, and that in and of itself would allow the tenant or the landlord to break the lease.
Representative Mulry.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, unfortunately, the courts basically are usually requiring that. I go back far enough that I was the organizer of the neighborhood to push that when Dawkins originally introduced that bill. And the intent was to be just the civil preponderance of the evidence. Both the police and others and the city prosecutors have told me that in essence they pretty much require a conviction in most cases of each incident. So statute doesn't say that
practicality is pretty much that, at least in Hennepin.
The goal that we want in this law is to, I think, to get rid of the problem actor in a neighborhood. And for lack of better specificity, it's the place that's defined in law, which would be the place of rent, leasing the property or an apartment, and perhaps the grounds outside the building. What I think this bill is trying to do is make a partner with the landlord, the good landlords, to take action. But in order to take action, I think we have to give them some provisions so that they don't get sued by the tenant in the event that they're moving as quickly as they can. That we could put them in the middle of two powers. And I think what the Senate language in this portion of the bill is trying to do is create that opportunity. Now, if the landlord is a bad actor and he doesn't want to engage in this, then the city has their own opportunities to go pursue the landlord. And certainly the public nuisance call is continued. And so then that triggers other things that the city can do. But if we're really trying to get after the bad actors in the neighborhood, we need to empower the landlord.
Thank you. The second question I had for Mr. Choi or for counsel is, 60-day notice, you got five instances here that we already need. And I'm a landlord and I own a property, and say I have two drive-by shootings, a murder, and criminal sexual conduct, second degree, felonies, all felonies. Why do I need an initial 60-day notice if there's problems with my property? I mean, how far out of touch do you need to be to get an additional 60-day notice requirement saying, well, by the way, absentee landlord, you got a problem with your property? Why do we need this? Mr. Choi.
Well, I think I don't necessarily want to defend that provision, but I think maybe just let me just lay out some things that maybe why you would want to have the 60-day provision. I think the premise under public nuisance law under 617.80, which is kind of modeled after, this bill is kind of modeled after that too, with respect to this provision, you're giving the opportunity for some abatement to occur. So just you're officially giving notice to the landlord to say, these are the problems. Now, I know you say that if there are five incidences, how could they not know? But I guess one scenario that I could see is what if they're targeting gangs who are dealing drugs and they're taking the surveillance approach, and so they've got cameras focused on a certain place or a certain area that they're focused on these activities, and maybe they're doing an undercover surveillance for 12 months and the police are letting the activities occur so that they can gather the evidence so that they could move forward with a civil case like this. Maybe the landlord may not know that this is happening. Maybe that's just a scenario that I would just throw out there, and I don't know if that's realistic, but I think it could be.
Okay, so Mr. Choi, are you saying that these five instances, you could proceed forward, your office could proceed forward on a civil action without having convictions on these, and that we could put to the finder of fact by a preponderance of the evidence that there were that there was a murder and a criminal sexual conduct and a drive-by shooting?
No, if it was a serious crime, if it was not to say that the drug dealing isn't serious, but if there are certain things that if there was, like, for instance, a murder, there would be an ongoing criminal investigation. So we're also going to be somewhat limited in our ability to even use this statute. If there was, at a place, somebody got murdered, and there were some other incidents that occurred, highly doubtful that any city attorney's office is going to be trying to get a civil gang injunction, because there'd be an inability to get the information that you would need to even prove the civil case, because it would be, a lot of that stuff would be restricted because it would be an ongoing criminal investigation. I'm sure the prosecuting attorney would not want that information or, you know, police officers giving testimony and things like that.
And Mr. Choi, although you know, I think also that those of us who work with neighborhood groups know that that is the one time when there is going to be the biggest outcry from community groups to take some kind of action like this in the wake of a heinous crime that makes the headlines. Senator Betzel.
Well, but Mr. Chair, you keep referring to heinous crimes. We don't need this bill to deal with heinous crimes. We already have things. It's my understanding that the reason why we're even talking about this bill is because there are things that gangs do that are a nuisance. And we'd like to kind of get them out of our hand, move them out, keep them to stop doing what they're doing. But we can't, there's nothing in the law right now to put the clamps down on them. If they commit a heinous crime, that's taken care of. The laws are already there. But if we're going to talk about declaring, say, an apartment building as a public nuisance, the least we ought to be able to do is tell the landlord that there's, you know, things going on there and give the landlord the opportunity to evict these people or do something about it so it's there. And even in the definitions in both the House and the Senate bill, we don't even know if it's the same individuals who've been doing it. We talk about five separate incidents or five times. It's not even said that it's got to be the same person. So there could be people in and out doing stuff that for whatever reason, it's bothering other people, good law-abiding people, they want to stop, and we can't nail them any other way, so we're going to do it. But the whole purpose of, this bill is, to, number one, if you don't even need to tie it to a place, to get somebody to bring a lawsuit to declare them a public nuisance, I don't know what you do with, what kind of injunction you have there. Or if you tie it to a place, move them out of the place. They're going to show up somewhere else. But that's, I think that the thing's here. So talk about drive-by shootings and murders. You don't need this to take care of that.
Well, Senator Betzel, I respectfully submit, first of all, we're talking about a little bit different thing here. We're not talking about depriving freedom in a criminal action, which requires a much higher standard of proof. This is a civil action that requires preponderance of the evidence, which is much easier to achieve, and the remedy is very different. We're essentially restricting movement. We're not incarcerating someone. So I think that's why we would need this. I do hear your point that this is going to be targeted towards those nuisance quality of life crimes. However, my question toward Mr. Choi was whether or not we could use those actions, which would normally be considered heinous crimes, and possibly warranting incarceration if we can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. But I want to know if we prove them by a preponderance of the evidence, like, an O.J. Simpson wrongful death suit, for example, if it were proven by a preponderance, could we still use it for that? Because I know that's when community groups are going to be clamoring for it. From what I hear you saying, Mr. Choi, is that we would not, correct? Because of the ongoing investigation.
Well, the reality is, always the more important criminal case is going to take precedence. So if we've got a felony murder, that's got to proceed on its own first. And the prosecuting attorney, the Hennepin, or the Ramsey County attorney would certainly not appreciate any city attorney trying to get a civil gang injunction for somebody who is under indictment for murder. The criminal case needs to proceed, and they need to have all of their evidence, and we shouldn't be disturbing that in any way.
And I'll call on Representative Cornish, but first, the second question I had for you in addressing part of Senator Betzold's comments is, as I understand it, we could not enjoin a landlord from renting to the White Tigers or renting to the Lower Town Gangsters. As I understand it, we need to name individuals in this suit. So I anticipate if there were a suit, it would name individual members of the East Side Boys and a particular landlord who we think is renting to one or more of them. Is that correct?
That's correct. And in fact, I even have some examples of what an order may look like. These are instances from San Diego, but in the cases talk about, you should have specific specific allegations towards specific individuals, so that you make that connection. But I'll pass this around if anybody wants to see what an example might look
like. Sure, why don't we have those passed around. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, I think the piece we're missing here is who we should have here is the street cop to direct us really what help he or she wants. If it's the place or the person or the combination of the two that we could have sitting here and say, this is what we should focus on and direct us. And then this side-by-side, a little hard for me to understand. You're operating off a different one than I am. And if we can narrow it down to themes, like first decide on place and penalty, what's regular, the type of notice, and where we differ, instead of the broad concept, start to narrow it down and make it easier for me. But I wish we had the gang task force person here that actually saw this stuff going on and say, this is what we'd like to control, and this would really help us and help us to narrow our focus a little bit.
Mr. Choi, did you want to address some of those issues?
Well, I guess. I think those are your issues about how you want to figure this all out.
I'm
just here to help out.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, can we just get through the side-by-side and the differences, and then once we know what the difference between the Senate and the House is, we can come back and question the differences in the provisions, just so that we can get through the side-by-side in case we run out of time.
We can do that.
And the members can go, you know, if we need to recess or adjourn, members can contemplate or cogitate on what those differences are and what people will be willing to, you know, whether they like a certain provision or don't like a certain provision, and then when we come back, we can really have a chance to ask questions. Because I agree with Representative Cornish, if we delve into the specifics, then we sort of lose the big picture of where things lie.
I think that's probably an appropriate course of action, Senator Moore. Mr. Gehring, are we up to Section 4 yet?
Yes, that's next.
Okay, why don't we proceed with that?
I think just to clarify.
Mr. Chair, and if I could ask counsel, could you present first what the House language says and then just tell us, you know, what the Senate language says that's in addition to that, so that we can just, that will be helpful, because the House is the base bill and then the Senate just changes that.
I can do that. And also, just to clarify, I don't think there's an actual official side-by-side to this bill. The side-by-side is just the summary. So I have something that looks like a side-by-side, but it's just the way the printer works. Section 4 deals with the actual court order. The House says that if a court finds that a criminal gang constitutes public nuisance, they may enter a temporary or permanent order enjoining the defendants from engaging in future gang activities and imposing other requirements to prevent the gang from engaging in future activities. There's also a definition of reasonable requirements. The House and Senate versions on this definition are identical, except for it's worded a little bit differently. On the House side, we say that the court is imposing reasonable requirements, and imposing reasonable requirements must balance state interest in public safety against constitutional First Amendment freedom of association requirements. On this provision, the Senate side just says that I believe the court must enter reasonable requirements consistent with the constitutional rights of the defendant, so it's a little bit broader in that respect. The House version also allows the court to impose reasonable requirements to prevent future use of the place for gang activity. On the Senate side, the difference is here. The Senate specifies the standard the court must, the evidentiary standard the court must use to issue the order, specifies that it's a preponderance of the evidence standard. It also specifies at the end of paragraph C that the reasonable requirements that the court may impose may include cancellation of a lease pursuant to the requirements of section 6, chapter 617, and any other reasonable requirements in the order. So
I think we can proceed.
I think this section is substantively pretty similar. Section 5 deals with what takes place if there's a violation of the court order. The House version says that A person who violates either a temporary or permanent order under the section is subject to either a fine of between $1,000 or $10,000, a jail sentence of between 10 and 30 days or both. The Senate version has a similar provision for imposition of a fine. It does not specify the between 10 and 30 day jail sentence, but it does specify that criminal penalty could be imposed. It would be a misdemeanor to violate a injunction.
I do have a question on that. Mr. Choi, how many $1,000 fines do you think we'll actually collect if we impose them?
Probably not too many, I would imagine, but you never know.
What do you anticipate would be the most likely penalty that your office would pursue on a violation that's established by a preponderance of the evidence?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, Mr. Chairman, I think what you're saying is, if I could just rephrase it so that I totally understand it, after we get the civil injunction, then how would it be used is what you're asking.
Correct. Right?
And I think what that would be is from enforcing a violation of the order as a misdemeanor crime.
Then a follow-up question. If it was enforced as a misdemeanor crime and proven beyond a reasonable doubt in the criminal court, what would you be looking for as a penalty, or what would you be arguing for as a bench guideline that the bench would impose as a penalty for that misdemeanor violation?
I haven't thought that through as to what would be, as an office policy, what we would be asking for, but I think we would want a maximum penalty given the fact of the amount of resources that we put into making all this occur. But the reality is the judges probably aren't going to give the maximum sentence.
Well, then I would just make one other comment, unless there are any other comments before we move on to the next section. It's that I think when new laws like this are enacted, one of the biggest hurdles in seeing them realized is the training that the judges need to go through and seeing them as a serious matter. Oftentimes I see the bench give a wink and a nod to these things because of the other nature of the crimes they see, and the bench is going to need to be educated. So I would just encourage you to do that, and I do my best as well.
And Mr. Chairman, let me just also respond to that. Actually, we're already actually thinking about that. In fact, we've already gathered video that we would not proceed on if this bill were to pass, that it wouldn't be used for any other criminal investigation. But we are kind of forming a kind of a PowerPoint presentation already on to the bench directly so that they understand how we're contemplating how this would work and have a discussion about it in advance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we can proceed to the next section then, Mr. Carey.
Okay. Section 6 is a section dealing with attorney's fees. Both the House and Senate versions are the same. They say that attorney's fees may be awarded in these cases. And Section 7, on the House side, says that proof of gang activity by a member of a criminal gang is frequently committed at a place, of proof that the place is frequently used for engaging in gang activity is prima facie evidence that the person who owns or is responsible for maintaining the place knowingly permitted the act. And the House version ends there. The differences between that language and the Senate, first, this is similar use of continuously or regularly committed versus frequently, which is a linguistic thing. And also the Senate adds paragraph B, which is essentially an affirmative defense that permits an owner or person responsible for a property to provide evidence that the person has made reasonable efforts to prevent the gang activity from occurring.
Thank you. Are there questions from any members regarding the sections that have been gone through? If there are not,
Senator Betzel. Let me point out the term continuously or regularly is a defined term in the section in both bills. And we slight different as to how it's defined, but it is a defined term. And I think in the Senate we were concerned that the way the bill was drafted and introduced, the term continuous and regular was used in the public nuisance section, but then after that, they used the term frequently. And we said that frequently was not defined, and if it was used, how is that different from continuously or regularly? So we figured it was more important to use a defined term than something that was not defined if we're going to be set in standard. So that's just something that, you know, that's the reason everybody chose to use that.
Thank you. If there are no other comments from members, I think the chief purpose of today in my conversation with Senator Moore was to go through it line by line, which we did. I think an appropriate thing to do is to come back the next time. Senator Moore will have the gavel, and we can propose changes or offers from each side. Does that sound appropriate to you, Senator Moore and other members?
Mr. Chair, given the time constraints and that we have board sessions and other conference committees meeting, I think that I would appreciate if we could just get input. It isn't like it's a lengthy 100-page bill, just a couple of pages. And what I would like to do is I don't know what kind of time you have, but I'd like to get some input from the conference committee members on specific areas, and then perhaps the committee members will give us the latitude of you and me trying to put something together that might work for the members. And the next time we meet, we bring it back for the members to chew on. I don't anticipate that this ought to be a long, laborious process. And so if it's all right with the group, I'd like to ask, maybe we can spend 10, 15 minutes now looking at the different provisions and getting input, and then maybe you and I can bring some, work with council to bring some suggested compromise back to the members of the conference committee for their approval.
I'm okay with that if members are okay on the time schedule. We're at about an hour and 15 minutes we've done so far, and I'm okay with taking another 15 if members are. In light of that, are there suggestions or input that we have from members at this point?
One of the questions I had is under the court order portion under Section 4 of the bill, we make reference to the court balance. In the House, it says balance state interest and public safety against constitutional First Amendment freedom of association requirements.
And then, Section 4?
Yes. And then in the Senate language, we make reference to consistent with constitutional rights of the defendant. And I guess I haven't seen this type of instruction to the court too often in the laws. I would assume that the courts would have that balance anyway as they're considering criminal charges against a defendant. I don't know how we had that reference in both. Maybe it was just comfort language that we placed there, knowing that we're tiptoeing toward a particular challenge or a reference to a challenge. But I'm just curious how it got there in the first place.
Senator Walsh.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lumber, I can't recall if we talked about this, maybe not at length in the Judiciary Committee, but when I was reviewing the bill to present to the committee, I had actually gone and read the court cases in other jurisdictions where this was in Chicago, their initial provision was struck down, and some other areas where there were some constitutionality issues implicated. And what I was trying to achieve in the language in the Senate provision was to make note that there are some constitutional issues here that we need to take into consideration. And I didn't quite know how to eloquently put that, so I asked Ms. Pontius to help draft the language that perhaps would pass muster with respect to the constitutional rights of individuals. I've also had some input from the ACLU who are concerned. I think in other jurisdictions, when this law has been put into effect, the
ACLU have raised strenuous opposition, and so I ran some of this language by them. You will notice that when we had the debate on the Senate floor, I can't recall if they sent a letter, but they have embedded with some of this language to the extent that they have not raised overwhelming opposition to the language. That doesn't mean they're okay with it, but I think that they might feel, and I don't want to speak for them, but I think what we are trying to do is to provide enough recognition that there's certain constitutional rights that have to be taken into consideration.
Senator Limmer, I'm of the same mind as you. When I saw this language in the original bill, I thought it was superfluous, and that a court is constitutionally required to consider First Amendment balancing tests in light of deprivation of any kind of right like this. That said, when marketing this bill to others, I heavily cited that section to people because, you know, they thought, "Wow, we're enacting a law that violates the Constitution," which of course is illegal. You can't, but you can't continue to explain that to people. So you have the comfort language in. And in fact, it helped me out in caucus when one member suggested that we don't do constitutional balancing tests for First Amendment, and I had to explain that yes, we do all the time. That's fundamentally what we do with First Amendment. But Representative Mulready.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's part of what I was going to say is I like the statement notifying the court they must balance these, and I don't know if I can go back and find my file, but I Senator Moore was referencing the Chicago case, which the first time around went to the U.S. Supreme Court and was thrown out, and Justice what's her name that just retired. She actually, in the opinion, said if you had changed your ordinance to say this, it would be constitutional. So they went back and used that in their second shot, and of course it was upheld. It was O'Connor, but there is a balance in here, and these types of things are being upheld by courts. And I'm trying to, I have a lot of notes in my file someplace because I talked to the chief prosecutor for Chicago on this. And, but the initial ACLU arguments were not upheld by the courts.
One of the obvious things that I see in the House language is that it only makes reference to one constitutional freedom. And the Senate language is a little bit broader, consistent with the constitutional rights of the defendant. And of course, the First Amendment freedom of association is one thing, but if the perpetrators were spray painting something on the side of that apartment building, now you have freedom of speech issue, which isn't referenced in the House language. So perhaps maybe a blend of the language or a broader reference to the context of the Constitution might be better.
Okay. Are there any other comments or feedback from members on the different sections?
Mr. Chair, one of the other references I looked at was Section 3, and I talked to counsel sitting next to me of how we arrived at the Senate language of the 60 days that you had mentioned. And maybe you could better explain it, but it was modeled after public nuisance laws that are already on the books. And I was trying to determine how we arrived at the 60 days. I don't recall how we arrived at the 60 days. I know that I'm sure that the public nuisance laws are already on the books, but I'll let our counsel better explain it.
Council?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator, I don't recall there. I think the 60 days, it may have been something that some of the landlord associations wanted just so they would have more time, but it's correct. The other nuisance law is a 30-day notice rather than a 60-day notice, so that's something to think about.
Mr. Choi, do you have any insight into how it ended up to be 60 days? it relate to
I think that was probably what the Landlord Association was asking for, and I think if you have 60 days, that certainly gives them, they can't argue that they don't have the opportunity to give them that 30-day notice to get out of, if they're going to invoke the terms and conditions of their lease. Usually there's probably a 30-day provision, notice provision.
Representative Cornish?
My comments were more in the form of advice is how to help you folks out. I'm perfectly comfortable with you folks getting together in the interim and then getting a real side-by-side, and then off the side, layman's comments and how they differ, and then possibly Mr. Choi, and then a peace officer, and you two, and just gel out the main theme points and put them together and bring them back to us.
Senator Moore?
I appreciate that input. I think that you know, one of the things that we will just have to look at, and I would take advice from the committee, is I think that at some point we should make a decision as a group on the definition section and whether we want to be consistent. And I just want to put out there that I think that the Senate language of continuously or regularly provides consistency, and I think definitionally it's cleaner and clearer from a constitutional mustard standpoint. And the reason why I said that is because I think the Chicago case that was struck down said that there was some vagueness issue with how that statute was how it was drafted. And so when I was working on this, I asked Mr. Choi and Ms. Pontius to help address the issue of vagueness, and that's where we arrived at that definition. The only reason why I say that, and we could choose to disagree with it, but then that language and that definitional language is carried out throughout the bill, and I think we would eliminate a whole lot of sections where the House and Senate language is inconsistent if we decide on the definitional issues on how we want to word that.
Representative Lawrence.
Mr. Chairman, and I don't disagree, Senator Moon, but the Chicago, as I recall, the main problem at the U.S. Supreme Court the first time around was the definition of loitering, and because that was the main part of the statute. They took a little different approach, and I was going to ask Mr. Choi where this idea came from, because it's not really the Chicago approach, although it's very similar, which Washington, D.C. also adopted after Chicago. What they did was, but in that case, and it was important to the court that in Chicago, it was like a police chief or something, or the city council, I can't remember, but it differs by city, would designate a certain area as either a drug zone or a criminal gang zone or something like that, and then anybody seen in that area, once they were notified, could not be back in that area, or it would be a criminal offense if they were in there for within so many days after being notified not to be in there. That's, while similar to this, I was, Mr. Chair, is it okay to ask?
Yes.
Mr. Choi, I was wondering where this came from exactly, because it, as Senator Moore said, it does in some ways similar to those types of cases or ordinances in Chicago, Washington, D.C., and yet it's, I'm trying to think of,
Mr.
Cincinnati has one similar,
yeah.
But
there's
a lot that don't have that actual notice first required.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering why we chose to have the first notice required.
Mr. Choi?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mullery, I think the key case that would really talk about this type of approach is the Acuna case, which is a California Supreme Court case. And I'll give you the citation, because I know you're an attorney, so this will mean something to you. It is 929 Pacific Reporter, 2nd edition, 596. And I have a copy of the case, and after this conference committee, I can just give you this, and I can get another copy back at the office. But that case essentially talked about having, I think the key issue in Acuna in terms of how they kind of rationalize how this type of approach could be constitutional is that ultimately the judge is going to make a decision after an evidentiary hearing, and you avoid some of the issues that were in the Morales case, which is the Chicago case that you referenced. And I think one of the main issues, and you're right, Senator Connor talked about this in terms of how you might avoid it, but one of the big issues was the unfettered discretion that the police officers would have in really interpreting the words of that ordinance, because there was a lot of deference given to the exercise of that police enforcement power. And I think in CUNA, you know, what they focus on very much is the fact that, and if we take this approach, what we're doing is ultimately the judge will make a decision after an evidentiary hearing. Now, granted, if there's a temporary injunction that's granted, we'll have the Dahlberg factors that would, you know, and the Dahlberg factors are the likelihood of success on the merits at trial and all of those things that would be a part of the Dahlberg factors. But ultimately, there will be a trial on this, and there will be an evidentiary hearing, and that's what the CUNA court in California focused on. And really, this, I would say, that kind of is the model for this bill, and also the Texas approach as well, and what they're doing now today in California on a very, very regular basis. And if you just do a search for civil gang injunctions, what you'll find in the newspapers is up and down the coast of California, cities are using this as a tool because of the CUNA case, and they're following essentially this approach.
Mr. Knowles, you have a follow-up?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Troy, and maybe this is I'm glad to see this coming, it's in the way, and hopefully it'll have an effect, but there's, as I recall, there's a number of cities, states have passed laws on it, that are not using this, where you have to basically either have somebody declare it an area or and then notify people. In essence, you're doing the same here. The judge is declaring this and then notifying people. There's some that are using it, as I recall, for loitering or for gang activity. And you don't have to notify them first, and maybe that's something for next year or whatever, but mm-hmm. I just wondered how you happened to.
Senator, was that a question for Mr. Choi?
I just wondered how they happened to.
Okay, so why don't we do that? And Senator Moore, you had a comment, but and then you can ask that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, we created this for use in Minnesota, and I think when this committee is done, we will create the Minnesota model on how we use this. And perhaps it will be so good that other states and other conference committees will say, this is the Minnesota language. But I think we had, on the Senate side, and I can't speak on the House side, we had members of the Judiciary Committee who are very thoughtful, and we took a lot of time to go through the bill. And we actually took a lot of time to work with the landlord association, as well as with the different city attorneys who are interested in this and working with council, and taking into consideration the cases that are out there. And so we may not have pegged our language specifically to someone else's experience, but the definitional areas that we've addressed in the Senate language is our attempt to try to capture, using other jurisdictions' experience as an indication for where we want to go, but really this is language that's being crafted for Minnesota to be used in the state of Minnesota, and I think that the proposals we have here have been crafted in a way that's very thoughtful, has been very broad in sort of what the scope where we're looking to get some guidance. But this is for Minnesota, and we can't really, I think that in this area, I think that the different jurisdictions out there are all over the map in terms of, you know, how they peg it, and it's on a case-by-case basis. So there isn't going to be a jurisdiction where we're going to be able to grab their language and apply exactly to where we're at, because it's in development. So I really appreciate the work of the two committees in the House and the Senate who have put a lot of work into this. This is groundbreaking, this is new stuff, and I think that once we achieve what this bill does, we will be looked at as a leader in this area, and other states will be looking at our language as model language and how to use this approach in their areas.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So
a few minutes ago started talking about the definitions, and it did bring back one more discussion that we had in the Senate on this. And let me just point this out to you. As I mentioned earlier, the term, if you look at the House bill, continuously or regularly is defined, but it appears once, and only once, within the House bill, and that is on page 1, line 17. When you're trying to define what public nuisance is within a gang activity. A criminal gang that continuously or regularly engages in gang activities is a public nuisance. And we thought that was a bit circular, but that's how it's defined. Now, it refers to gang activities, which is another defined term, and it does refer to, and it's on page 1, starting line 12, and it defines a gang activity. So one of the things the Senate had concerns about is the fact that when you're talking about continuously or regularly, meaning at least five times, and we're talking about a nuisance being a gang activity, it is possible that one instance could be five different things in the gang activity. You could have a trespass, which leads to criminal damage. You get some other things. So was it the intent to say that when they did this one act, which you could identify within five different areas of the law, does that constitute a nuisance? Or, as the Senate suggested, should it be five separate incidents? Whichever way we come down, I think we need to clarify that. Because that's one of the first things that, as I recall, the Senate honed in on, saying, does five times mean five different things, or one thing that you can count five different ways under gang activity? So that's why we try to parse it out as the way we did in our definition. So Senator Long raised that, and that we called that was part of our discussion.
I would bring up two things as food for thought. One being the Senate removed the authority of an individual to bring suit, and I have some concerns about that because I know sometimes the resources of government is stretched thin, and I would like to think if a community council or a district council or a neighborhood group saw fit to bring suit on their own, and there was an enterprising attorney in the neighborhood who sought to do this, that they could do it on their own and still get attorney's fees for it if they were able. The second item is, currently, we're at five instances. It is, in fact, five instances, as Senator Betzel highlighted. I think if, in fact, we're going to be modifying how we look at this, then perhaps closer to the two-instance standard, which is the standard under nuisance law, might be more appropriately looked at if, in fact, considering the discussion that was had today. So I would just put those out there.
Mr. Chair, as to your first point, I've already addressed the five. Whether it's five or less, I don't know. We felt five times is not specific, and it had, could be subject to interpretation. On the resident part, we had some concerns. We felt if it rises to the level of being a public nuisance, we understand that real citizens care about these things. There are neighborhood groups that are concerned. But we have some concerns about empowering every individual, the state, to bring an action to declare a public nuisance. And we figured if it's important enough to declare it a public nuisance, then you ought to involve somebody at a county attorney level, city attorney, attorney general, or somebody. Now, perhaps that could be expanded, but I think the Senate is a bit uncomfortable about saying that any person in the state could bring this action. I think it has to be more defined than that. And if it's one person, maybe against the rest of the world, and just may bring this because they don't like kids in the street corner. I think that could this be used for that? Possibly. But I think that we have some concerns about that.
Well, let me suggest in light of that, and I understand that, and I hear what you say, but if a person decides to bring suit on that, it's on their own nickel, unless they can achieve attorney's fees, of course, which they wouldn't if, in fact, it was a frivolous action. But the nuisance law statutes do provide for a private attorney general cause of action as well, I believe, and I don't know if it's ever been used, actually. I mean, if nuisance actions are ever brought, they're brought by the locals. And I think having that in there is, I don't know, a handy accountability thing where a city or a county can say to individuals, listen, we're not pursuing this because we don't have it. If you want to do it yourself, have at it. You're probably not going to win, but it provides for that outlet. So that's why I think it's important. But Mr. Choi, did you have a response to that?
Well, it's not necessarily a response. I do want to just clarify, though, that the under 617.80, which is under the state public nuisance law, the authority is given to something called the prosecuting attorney, and that is defined as it's limited to the attorney general, county attorney, or city attorney, or an attorney serving the jurisdiction where the nuisance is located. So they don't have it under the nuisance law to allow for private citizens to sue under 617.80.
The reason I brought that up is because when I first did this in 1997, I think, it was when I was interning for Representative Dawkins,
yeah.
And there was the private attorney general cause of action. So am I wrong on that, or perhaps Senator Moore can clarify?
I can't clarify that, Mr. Chair, but let me put this in the words. Part of the reason why, as an author, and I believe I took that out as an author's amendment upon reflection input from the Judiciary Committee members, I just have some real concerns. These are gangsters that we're dealing with. And I think that as much as we want to have the public go at it, there's sort of a public safety concern that I have. I think it's different when, that's why we make criminal law sort of, the public official be the prosecutor. We don't make it personal. When it comes to gangs and gang activities, I think we should take a step back. I wouldn't want the District 1 council to sue a group of gangsters who are gathering at, one of our rec centers or one of the parks. I think that it poses some public safety concerns for those private individuals. I mean, at least if it's a public entity or if it's the prosecutor or the city, there's sort of an anonymous face to who is enforcing the injunctions against them and who is imposing the penalties. But to expect public citizens to obtain the injunction and then for them to somehow be able to enforce it, it kind of decouples, I think, the enforcement if you don't have a public entity with the enforcement power to enforce the injunction. Plus, I think it puts the public citizen in jeopardy. What if the gangsters get pissed off enough and they decide that they want to retaliate? So upon reflection, the reason why I took out individuals out is that I was just concerned, for the safety of the individuals, as courageous as they may be, and some of them will be angry enough to want to do it on their own without going to the public entity. So I just want to put it out there for our consideration.
Are there any other comments from members regarding food for thought before we come back the next time we convene?
Mr. Chair, I also would encourage that the House members might want to continue to give you feedback and thought and the direction where they would like to go. And likewise, I know that my Senate members would continue to give me feedback and thought on sort of our language and upon reflection of the House language. And we'll try to put something together.
Okay. If there are no other comments, then we will stand in recess until the next time we convene. And
we're not coming back today, I don't think we're coming back today. And maybe tomorrow, we'll try to see where we're at. But maybe late in the afternoon tomorrow.
Okay. Then please adjourn.